declared, abruptly returning from his thoughts. "Then taking Ms. Vidal to the palace is a deadly mistake." Fonseca spun around.
"What did you say?"
"I don't know who is giving you orders now, sir," Langdon said. "But if the prince truly wants to keep his fiancée safe, then I suggest you listen to me very carefully." He paused, his tone intensifying. "Edmund Kirsch was murdered to keep his discovery from going public, and whoever silenced him will stop at nothing to make sure that job is finished."
"It's finished already," Fonseca scoffed. "Edmund is dead."
"But his discovery is not," Langdon replied. "Edmund's presentation is very much alive and can still be released to the world."
"Which is why you came to his apartment," Diaz ventured. "Because you believe you can launch it."
"Precisely," Langdon replied. "And that has made us targets. I don't know who manufactured the media statement claiming Ambra was kidnapped, but it was clearly someone desperate to stop us. So if you were part of that group, the people trying to bury Edmund's discovery forever, then you should simply toss Ms. Vidal and myself out of this helicopter right now while you still can." Ambra stared at Langdon, wondering if he'd lost his mind. "However," Langdon continued, "if your sworn duty as a Guardia Real agent is to protect the royal family, including the future Queen of Spain, then you need to realize there is no more dangerous place for Ms. Vidal right now than a palace that just issued a public statement that almost got her killed." Langdon reached into his pocket and extracted an elegantly embossed linen note card. "I suggest you take her to the address at the bottom of this card." Fonseca took the card and studied it, his brow furrowing.
"That's ridiculous."
"There is a security fence around the entire property," Langdon said. "Your pilot can touch down, drop the four of us off, and then fly away before anyone realizes we're even there. I know the person in charge. We can hide there, off the grid, until we sort this all out. You can accompany us."
"I'd feel safer in a military hangar at the airport."
"Do you really want to trust a military team that is probably taking orders from the same people who just nearly got Ms. Vidal killed?" Fonseca's stony expression never wavered. Ambra's thoughts were racing wildly now, and she wondered what was written on the card. Where does Langdon want to go? His sudden intensity seemed to imply there was more at stake than simply keeping her safe. She heard a renewed optimism in his voice and sensed he had not yet given up hope that they could somehow still launch Edmund's presentation. Langdon retrieved the linen card from Fonseca and handed it to Ambra. "I found this in Edmund's library." Ambra studied the card, immediately recognizing what it was. Known as loan logs or title cards, these elegantly embossed placeholders were given by museum curators to donors in exchange for a piece of artwork on temporary loan. Traditionally, two identical cards were printed, one placed on display in the museum to thank the donor, and one held by the donor as collateral for the piece he had loaned. Edmund loaned out his book of Blake's poetry? According to the card, Edmund's book had traveled no more than a few kilometers away from his Barcelona apartment. "The Complete Works of William Blake, from the private collection of Edmund Kirsch, on loan to La Basílica de la Sagrada Familia, Carrer de Mallorca, 401-08013, Barcelona, Spain."
"I don't understand," Ambra said. "Why would an outspoken atheist lend a book to a church?"
"Not just any church," Langdon countered. "Gaudí's most enigmatic architectural masterpiece." He pointed out the window into the distance behind them. "And soon to be the tallest church in Europe." Ambra turned her head, peering back across the city to the north. In the distance, surrounded by cranes, scaffolding, and construction lights, the unfinished towers of Sagrada Familia shone brightly, a cluster of perforated spires that resembled giant sea sponges climbing off the ocean floor toward the light. For more than a century, Gaudí's controversial Basilica de la Sagrada Familia had been under construction, relying solely on private donations from the faithful. Criticized by traditionalists for its eerie organic shape and use of biomimetic design, the church was hailed by modernists for its structural fluidity and use of hyperboloid forms to reflect the natural world.
"I'll admit it's unusual," Ambra said, turning back to Langdon. "But it's still a Catholic church, and you know Edmund."
"I do know Edmund," Langdon thought, "enough to know he believes Sagrada Familia hides a secret purpose and symbolism that go far beyond Christianity." Since the bizarre church's groundbreaking in 1882, conspiracy theories had swirled about its mysteriously encoded doors, cosmically inspired helicoid columns, symbol-laden facades, magic square mathematical carvings, and ghostly skeletal construction that clearly resembled twisting bones and connective tissue. Langdon was aware of the theories, of course, and yet never gave them much credence. A few years back, however, Langdon was surprised when Edmund confessed that he was one of a growing number of Gaudí fans who quietly believed that Sagrada Familia was secretly conceived as something other than a Christian church, perhaps even as a mystical shrine to science and nature. Langdon found the notion highly unlikely, and he reminded Edmund that Gaudí was a devout Catholic whom the Vatican had held in such high esteem that they christened him God's Architect, and even considered him for beatification. Sagrada Familia's unusual design, Langdon assured Kirsch, was nothing more than an example of Gaudí's unique modernist approach to Christian symbolism. Edmund's reply was a coy smile, as if he were secretly holding some mysterious piece of the puzzle that he was not ready to share. Another Kirsch secret, Langdon now thought, like his hidden battle with cancer.
"Even if Edmund did loan his book to Sagrada Familia," Umbra continued, "and even if we find it, we will never be able to locate the correct line by reading it page by page. And I really doubt Edmund used a highlighter on a priceless manuscript."
"Umbra," Langdon replied with a calm smile, "look at the back of the card." She glanced down at the card, flipped it over, and read the text on the back. Then, with a look of disbelief, Umbra read it again. When her eyes snapped back up to Langdon's, they were filled with hope. "As I was saying," Langdon said with a smile, "I think we should go there." Umbra's excited expression faded as quickly as it came.
"There is still a problem. Even if we find his password..."
"I know. We lost Edmund's phone, meaning we have no way to access Winston and communicate with him."
"Exactly."
"I believe I can solve that problem." Umbra eyed him skeptically.
"I'm sorry?"
"All we need is to locate Winston himself, the actual computer that Edmund built. If we no longer have access to Winston remotely, we'll just have to take the password to Winston in person." Umbra stared at him as if he were mad. Langdon continued, "You told me Edmund built Winston in a secret facility."
"Yes, but that facility could be anywhere in the world."
"It's not. It's here in Barcelona."
"It has to be.
Barcelona is the city where Edmund lived and worked, and building this synthetic intelligence machine was one of his most recent projects, so it only makes sense that Edmund would have built Winston here."
"Robert, even if you're right, you're looking for a needle in a haystack. Barcelona is an enormous city. It would be impossible..."
"I can find Winston," Langdon said. "I'm sure of it." He smiled and motioned to the sprawl of city lights beneath them. "This will sound crazy, but seeing this aerial view of Barcelona just now helped me realize something." His voice trailed off as he looked out the window.
"Would you care to elaborate?"
Umbra asked expectantly. I should have seen it earlier, he said. There's something about Winston, an intriguing puzzle, that has been bothering me all night. I think I finally figured it out. Langdon shot a cautious glance at the Guardia agents and then lowered his voice, leaning toward Ambra. Will you just trust me on this? He asked quietly. I believe I can find Winston. The problem is that finding Winston will do us no good without Edmund's password. Right now, you and I need to focus on finding that line of poetry. Sagrada Familia is our best chance of doing that. Ambra studied Langdon a long moment. Then, with a bewildered nod, she looked toward the front seat and called,
Agent Fonseca, please have the pilot turn around and take us to Sagrada Familia right away.
Fonseca spun in his seat, glaring at her.
Ms. Vidal, as I told you, I have my orders. Agent Fonseca,
interrupted the future Queen of Spain, leaning forward and locking eyes with him.
Take us to Sagrada Familia right now, or my first order of business when we return will be to have you fired.
Chapter 62 ConspiracyNet.com Breaking News Assassin Cult Connection. Thanks to yet another tip from Monte@Iglesia.org, we have just learned that Edmund Kearse's killer is a member of an ultra-conservative, secretive Christian sect known as the Palmarian Church. Luis Avila has been recruiting online for the Palmarians for more than a year now, and his membership in this controversial religio-military organization also explains the Victor tattoo on his palm. This Francoist symbol is in regular use by the Palmarian Church, which, according to Spain's national newspaper, El País, has its own pope and has canonized several ruthless leaders, including Francisco Franco and Adolf Hitler, as saints. Don't believe us? Look it up. It all began with a mystical vision. In 1975, an insurance broker named Clemente Domínguez y Gómez claimed to have had a vision in which he was crowned pope by Jesus Christ himself. Clemente took the papal name Gregory XVII, breaking from the Vatican and appointing his own cardinals. Although rejected by Rome, this new anti-pope amassed thousands of followers and vast wealth, enabling him to construct a fortress-like church, expand his ministry internationally, and consecrate hundreds of Palmarian bishops worldwide. The schismatic Palmarian Church still functions today out of its world headquarters, a secure, walled compound called the Mount of Christ the King in El Palmar de Troya, Spain. The Palmarians are not recognized by the Vatican in Rome, and yet continue to attract an ultra-conservative Catholic following. More news on this sect soon, as well as an update on Bishop Antonio Valdespino, who also seems to be implicated in tonight's conspiracy. Chapter 63
Okay, I'm impressed, Langdon thought.
With a few strong words, Ambra had just forced the crew of the EC-145 helicopter to make a wide banking turn and redirect toward the Basilica of the Sagrada Familia. As the aircraft leveled out and began skimming back across the city, Ambra turned to Agent Diaz and demanded the use of his cell phone, which the Guardia agent reluctantly handed over. Ambra promptly launched his browser and began scanning news headlines.
Damn, she whispered, shaking her head with frustration. I tried to tell the media you did not kidnap me. Nobody could hear me.
Maybe they need more time to post? Langdon offered. This happened less than 10 minutes ago.
They've had enough time, she replied. I'm seeing video clips of our helicopter speeding away from Casamela.
Already? Langdon sometimes felt that the world had begun to spin too quickly on its axis. He could still recall when breaking news was printed on paper and delivered to his doorstep the following morning.
By the way,
Ambra said with a trace of humor,
It appears you and I are one of the world's top trending news stories.
I knew I shouldn't have kidnapped you, he replied wryly.
Not funny. At least we're not the number one story.
She handed him the phone.
Have a look at this.
Langdon eyed the screen and saw the Yahoo homepage with its top 10 trending now stories. He looked to the top at the most popular story. 1. Where do we come from? Edmund Kirsch. Clearly, Edmund's presentation had inspired people around the globe to research and discuss the topic. Edmund would be so pleased, Langdon thought. But when he clicked the link and saw the first 10 headlines, he realized he was wrong. The top 10 theories for Where Do We Come From were all stories about creationism and extraterrestrials. Edmund would be horrified. One of Langdon's former students' most infamous rants had occurred at a public forum called Science and Spirituality, where Edmund had become so exasperated by audience questions that he finally threw up his hands and stalked off the stage, shouting, "How is it that intelligent human beings cannot discuss their origins without invoking the name of God and fucking aliens?" Langdon kept scanning down the phone screen until he found a seemingly innocuous CNN Live link titled, "What Did Kirsch Discover?" He launched the link and held the phone so Ambra could see it as well. As the video began to play, he turned up the volume, and he and Ambra leaned together so they could hear the video over the roar of the helicopter's rotors. A CNN anchor appeared. Langdon had seen her broadcasts many times over the years.
"We are joined now by NASA astrobiologist Dr. Griffin Bennett," she said, "who has some ideas regarding Edmund Kirsch's mysterious breaking discovery. Welcome, Dr. Bennett."
The guest, a bearded man in wire-rimmed glasses, gave a somber nod. "Thank you. First off, let me say that I knew Edmund personally. I have enormous respect for his intelligence, his creativity, and his commitment to progress and innovation. His assassination has been a terrible blow to the scientific community, and I hope this cowardly murder will serve to fortify the intellectual community to stand united against the dangers of zealotry, superstitious thinking, and those who resort to violence, not facts, to further their beliefs. I sincerely hope the rumors are true that there are people working hard tonight to find a way to bring Edmund's discovery to the public." Langdon shot Ambra a glance.
"I think he means us."
She nodded.
"There are many people who are hoping for that as well, Dr. Bennett," the anchor said. "And can you shed any light on what you think the content of Edmund Kirsch's discovery might be?"
"As a space scientist," Dr. Bennett continued, "I feel I should preface my words tonight with a blanket statement, one that I believe Edmund Kirsch would appreciate." The man turned and looked directly into the camera. "When it comes to the notion of extraterrestrial life," he began, "there exists a blinding array of bad science, conspiracy theory, and outright fantasy. For the record, let me say this. Crop circles are a hoax. Alien autopsy videos are trick photography. No cow has ever been mutilated by an alien. The Roswell saucer was a government weather balloon called Project Mogul. The Great Pyramids were built by Egyptians without alien technology. And most importantly, every extraterrestrial abduction story ever reported is a flat-out lie."
"How can you be sure, Doctor?" the anchor asked.
"Simple logic," the scientist said, looking annoyed as he turned back to the anchor. "Any life form advanced enough to travel light years through interstellar space would have nothing to learn by probing the rectums of farmers in Kansas. Nor would these life forms need to morph into reptiles and infiltrate governments in order to take over the Earth. Any life form with the technology to travel to Earth would require no subterfuge or subtlety to dominate us instantaneously."
"Well, that's alarming," the anchor commented with an awkward laugh.
And how does this relate to your thoughts on Mr. Kirsch's discovery? The man sighed heavily.
It is my strong opinion that Edmund Kirsch was going to announce that he had found definitive proof that life on Earth originated in space.
Langdon was immediately skeptical, knowing how Kirsch felt about the topic of extraterrestrial life on Earth.
Fascinating. What makes you say that?
The anchor pressed.
Life from space is the only rational answer. We already have incontrovertible proof that matter can be exchanged between planets. We have fragments of Mars and Venus, along with hundreds of samples from unidentified sources, which would support the idea that life arrived via space rocks in the form of microbes and eventually evolved into life on Earth.
The host nodded intently.
But hasn't this theory, microbes arriving from space, been around for decades with no proof?
How do you think a tech genius like Edmund Kirsch could prove a theory like this, which seems more in the realm of astrobiology than computer science?
Well, there's solid logic to it, Dr. Bennett replied. Top astronomers have warned for decades that humankind's only hope for long-term survival will be to leave this planet. The Earth is already halfway through its life cycle, and eventually the sun will expand into a red giant and consume us. That is, if we survive the more imminent threats of a giant asteroid collision or a massive gamma-ray burst. For these reasons, we are already designing outposts on Mars, so we can eventually move into deep space in search of a new host planet. Needless to say, this is a massive undertaking, and if we could find a simpler way to ensure our survival, we would implement it immediately.
Dr. Bennett paused. And perhaps there is a simpler way. What if we could somehow package the human genome in tiny capsules and send millions of them into space in hopes one might take root, seeding human life on a distant planet? This technology does not yet exist, but we are discussing it as a viable option for human survival. And if we are considering seeding life, then it follows that a more advanced life form might have considered it as well.
Langdon now suspected where Dr. Bennett was going with his theory.
With this in mind, he continued, I believe Edmund Kirsch may have discovered some kind of alien signature, be it physical, chemical, digital, I don't know, proving that life on Earth was seeded from space. I should mention that Edmund and I had quite a debate about this several years ago. He never liked the space microbe theory because he believed, as many do, that genetic material could never survive the deadly radiation and temperatures that would be encountered in the long journey to Earth. Personally, I believe that it would be perfectly feasible to seal these seeds of life in radiation-proof protective pods and shoot them into space, with the intent of populating the cosmos in a kind of technology-assisted panspermia.
Okay, the host said, looking unsettled. But if someone discovered proof that humans came from a seed pod sent from space, then that means we're not alone in the universe.
She paused.
But also, far more incredibly...
Yes?
Dr. Bennett smiled for the first time.
It means whoever sent the pods would have to be like us. Human.
Yes, my first conclusion as well. The scientist paused. Then Edmund set me straight. He pointed out the fallacy in that thinking.
This caught the host off guard.
So Edmund's belief was that whoever sent these seeds was not human? How could that be, if the seeds were, so to speak, recipes for human propagation?
Humans are half-baked, the scientist replied, to use Edmund's exact words.
I'm sorry?
Edmund said that if this seed pod theory were true, then the recipe that was sent to Earth is probably only half-baked at the moment, not yet finished, meaning humans are not the final product, but instead just a transitional species evolving toward something else, something alien.
The CNN anchor looked bewildered.
Any advanced life form, Edmund argued, would not send a recipe for humans any more than they would send a recipe for chimpanzees.
the scientist chuckled. In fact, Edmund accused me of being a closet Christian, joking that only a religious mind could believe that mankind is the center of the universe, or that aliens would airmail fully formed Adam and Eve DNA into the cosmos. Well, Doctor, the host said, clearly uncomfortable with the direction the interview was taking, it's certainly been enlightening speaking with you. Thank you for your time. The segment ended, and Ambra immediately turned to Langdon.
Robert, if Edmund discovered proof that humans are a half-evolved alien species, then it raises an even bigger issue. What exactly are we evolving into?
Yes, Langdon said. And I believe Edmund phrased that issue in a slightly different way, as a question. Where are we going? Ambra looked startled to have come full circle.
Edmund's second question from tonight's presentation.
Precisely. Where do we come from? Where are we going? Apparently the NASA scientist we've just watched thinks Edmund looked to the heavens and found answers to both questions.
What do you think, Robert? Is this what Edmund discovered?
Langdon could feel his brow furrow with doubt as he weighed the possibilities. The scientist's theory, while exciting, seemed far too general and otherworldly for the acute thinking of Edmund Kirsch. Edmund liked things simple, clean, and technical. He was a computer scientist. More importantly, Langdon could not imagine how Edmund would prove such a theory. Unearth an ancient seed pod? Detect an alien transmission? Both discoveries would have been instantaneous breakthroughs, but Edmund's discovery had taken time. Edmund said he had been working on it for months. Obviously, I don't know, Langdon told Ambra, but my gut tells me Edmund's discovery has nothing to do with extraterrestrial life. I really believe he discovered something else entirely. Ambra looked surprised and then intrigued.
I guess there's only one way to find out.
She motioned out the window. In front of them shone the glimmering spires of Sagrada Familia. Chapter 64 Bishop Valdespino stole another quick glance at Julian, who was still staring blankly out the window of the Opel sedan as it sped along Highway M-505.
What is he thinking? Valdespino wondered.
The prince had been silent for nearly 30 minutes, barely moving except for the occasional reflexive reach into his pocket for his phone, only to realize that he had locked it in his wall safe.
I need to keep him in the dark, Valdespino thought, just a bit longer.
In the front seat, the acolyte from the cathedral was still driving in the direction of Casita del Principe, although Valdespino soon would need to inform him that the prince's retreat was not their destination at all. Julian turned suddenly from the window, tapping the acolyte on the shoulder.
Please turn on the radio, he said. I'd like to hear the news.
Before the young man could comply, Valdespino leaned forward and placed a firm hand on the boy's shoulder.
Let's just sit quietly, shall we?
Julian turned to the bishop, clearly displeased at having been overridden.
I'm sorry, Valdespino said at once, sensing a growing distrust in the prince's eyes. It's late. All that chatter. I prefer silent reflection.
I've been doing some reflecting, Julian said, his voice sharp, and I'd like to know what's going on in my country. We've entirely isolated ourselves tonight, and I'm starting to wonder if it was a good idea.
It is a good idea, Valdespino assured him, and I appreciate the trust you've shown me.
He removed his hand from the acolyte's shoulder and motioned to the radio.
Please turn on the news. Perhaps Radio Maria España?
Valdespino hoped the worldwide Catholic station would be gentler and more tactful than most media outlets had been about tonight's troubling developments. When the newscaster's voice came over the cheap car speakers, he was discussing Edmund Kirsch's presentation and assassination.
Every station in the world is talking about this tonight.
Valdespino just hoped his own name would not come up as part of the broadcast. Fortunately, the topic at the moment appeared to be the dangers of the anti-religious message preached by Kirsch, especially the threat posed by his influence on the youth of Spain. As an example, the station began rebroadcasting a lecture Kirsch had delivered recently at the University of Barcelona. "Many of us are afraid to call ourselves atheists," Kirsch said calmly to the assembled students. "And yet atheism is not a philosophy, nor is atheism a view of the world. Atheism is simply an admission of the obvious." Several students clapped in agreement. "The term atheist," Kirsch continued, "should not even exist. No one ever needs to identify himself as a non-astrologer or a non-alchemist. We do not have words for people who doubt that Elvis is still alive, or for people who doubt that aliens traverse the galaxy only to molest cattle. Atheism is nothing more than the noises reasonable people make in the presence of unjustified religious beliefs." A growing number of students clapped their approval. "That definition is not mine, by the way," Kirsch told them. "Those words belong to neuroscientist Sam Harris. And if you have not already done so, you must read his book, Letter to a Christian Nation." Valdespino frowned, recalling the stir caused by Harris's book, Carta a una Nación Cristiana, which, while written for Americans, had reverberated across Spain. "By a show of hands," Kirsch continued, "how many of you believe in any of the following ancient gods? Apollo? Zeus? Vulcan?" He paused and then laughed. "Not a single one of you? Okay. So it appears we are all atheists with respect to those gods." He paused. "I simply choose to go one god further." The crowd clapped louder still. "My friends, I am not saying I know for a fact that there is no God. All I am saying is that if there is a divine force behind the universe, it is laughing hysterically at the religions we've created in an attempt to define it." Everyone laughed. Valdespino was now pleased that the prince had asked to listen to the radio. Julian needs to hear this. Kirsch's devilishly seductive charm was proof that the enemies of Christ were no longer sitting idly by, but rather were actively trying to pull souls away from God. "I'm an American," Kirsch continued, "and I feel profoundly fortunate to have been born in one of the most technologically advanced and intellectually progressive countries on earth. And so I found it deeply disturbing when a recent poll revealed that one half of my countrymen believe quite literally that Adam and Eve existed, that an all-powerful God created two fully formed human beings who single-handedly populated the entire planet, generating all the diverse races with none of the inherent problems of inbreeding." More laughter. "In Kentucky," he continued, "church pastor Peter LaRuffa publicly declared, 'If somewhere within the Bible I found a passage that said 2 + 2 = 5, I would believe it and accept it as true.'" Still more laughter. "I agree. It's easy to laugh. But I assure you, these beliefs are far more terrifying than they are funny. Many of the people who espouse them are bright, educated professionals, doctors, lawyers, teachers, and in some cases, people who aspire to the highest offices in the land. I once heard U.S. Congressman Paul Brown say, 'Evolution and the Big Bang are lies straight from the pit of hell. I believe the earth is about 9,000 years old, and it was created in 6 days as we know them.'" Kirsch paused. "Even more troubling, Congressman Brown sits on the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, and when questioned about the existence of a fossil record spanning millions of years, his response was, 'Fossils were placed there by God to test our faith.'" Kirsch's voice grew suddenly quiet and somber. "To permit ignorance is to empower it. To do nothing as our leaders proclaim absurdities is a crime of complacency, as is letting our schools and churches teach outright untruths to our children. The time for action has come. Not until we purge our species of superstitious thinking can we embrace all that our minds have to offer.
He paused, and a hush fell over the crowd. I love humankind. I believe our minds and our species have limitless potential. I believe we're on the brink of an enlightened new era. A world where religion finally departs and science reigns. The crowd erupted with wild applause.
For heaven's sake, Valdespino snapped, shaking his head in disgust. Turn it off.
The acolyte obeyed, and the three men drove on in silence. 30 miles away, Monica Martin was standing opposite a breathless Suresh Bala, who had just dashed in and handed her a cell phone.
Long story, Suresh gasped, but you need to read this text that Bishop Valdespino received. Hold on.
Martin almost dropped the device.
This is the bishop's phone? How the hell did you...
Don't ask, just read.
Alarmed, Martin directed her eyes to the phone and began reading the text on its screen. Within seconds, she felt herself blanch.
My God. Bishop Valdespino is...
Dangerous, Suresh said.
But this is impossible. Who is this person who texted the bishop?
Shielded number, Suresh said. I'm working on identifying it.
And why wouldn't Valdespino delete this message?
No idea, Suresh said flatly. Careless, arrogant. I'll try to undelete any other texts and also see if I can identify who Valdespino is texting with. But I wanted to give you this news on Valdespino right away. You'll have to make a statement on it.
No, I won't, Martin said, still reeling. The palace is not going public with this information.
No, but someone else will very soon. Suresh quickly explained that the motive for searching Valdespino's phone had been a direct email tip from monte@iglesia.org, the informant who was feeding news to ConspiracyNet. And if this person acted true to form, the bishop's text would not remain private for long. Martine closed her eyes, trying to picture the world's reaction to incontrovertible proof that a Catholic bishop with very close ties to the King of Spain was directly involved in tonight's treachery and murder.
Suresh, Martine whispered, slowly opening her eyes, I need you to figure out who this Monte informant is. Can you do that for me?
I can try. He did not sound hopeful.
Thanks.
Martin handed the bishop's phone back to him and hurried to the door.
And send me a screenshot of that text.
Where are you going?
Suresh called. Monica Martin did not answer. Chapter 65. La Sagrada Familia, the Basilica of the Holy Family, occupies an entire city block in central Barcelona. Despite its massive footprint, the church seems to hover almost weightlessly above the earth, a delicate cluster of airy spires that ascend effortlessly into the Spanish sky. Intricate and porous, the towers have varying heights, giving the shrine the air of a whimsical sandcastle erected by mischievous giants. Once completed, the tallest of the 18 pinnacles will climb a dizzying and unprecedented 560 feet, higher than the Washington Monument, making Sagrada Familia the tallest church in the world, eclipsing the Vatican's own St. Peter's Basilica by more than 100 feet. The body of the church is sheltered by three massive facades. To the east, the colorful Nativity facade climbs like a hanging garden, sprouting polychrome plants, animals, fruits, and people. In stark contrast, the Passion facade to the west is an austere skeleton of harsh stone hewn to resemble sinews and bone. To the south, the glory facade twists upward in a chaotic clutter of demons, idols, sins, and vices, eventually giving way to loftier symbols of ascension, virtue, and paradise. Completing the perimeter are countless smaller facades, buttresses, and towers, most of them sheathed in a mud-like material, giving the effect that the lower half of the building is either melting or has been extruded from the earth. According to one prominent critic, Sagrada Familia's lower half resembles a rotting tree trunk from which had sprouted a family of intricate mushroom spires. In addition to adorning his church with traditional religious iconography, Gaudí included countless startling features that reflected his reverence for nature: turtles supporting columns, trees sprouting from facades, and even giant stone snails and frogs scaling the outside of the building. Despite its outlandish exterior, the true surprise of Sagrada Familia is glimpsed only after stepping through its doorways. Once inside the main sanctuary, visitors invariably stand slack-jawed as their eyes climb the slanting and twisting tree trunk columns up 200 feet to a series of hovering vaults where psychedelic collages of geometric shapes hover like a crystalline canopy in the tree branches. The creation of a columned forest, Gaudí claimed, was to encourage the mind to return to thoughts of the earliest spiritual seekers, for whom the forest had served as God's cathedral. Not surprisingly, Gaudí's colossal Art Nouveau opus is both passionately adored and cynically scorned. Hailed by some as sensual, spiritual, and organic, it is derided by others as vulgar, pretentious, and profane. Author James Michener described it as one of the strangest-looking serious buildings in the world, and Architectural Review called it Gaudí's sacred monster. If its aesthetics are strange, its finances are even stranger. Funded entirely by private donations, Sagrada Familia receives no financial support whatsoever from the Vatican or the world Catholic leadership. Despite periods of near bankruptcy and work stoppages, the church exhibits an almost Darwinian will to survive, having tenaciously endured the death of its architect, a violent civil war, terrorist attacks by Catalan anarchists, and even the drilling of a subway tunnel nearby that threatened to destabilize the very ground on which it sits. In the face of incredible adversity, Sagrada Familia still stands and continues to grow. Over the past decade, the church's fortunes have improved considerably, its coffers supplemented by ticket sales to more than 4 million visitors a year, who pay handsomely to tour the partially completed structure. Now, having announced a target completion date of 2026, the centenary of Gaudí's death, Sagrada Familia seems to be infused with a fresh vigor, its spires climbing heavenward with a renewed urgency and hope. Father Joaquim Benya, Sagrada Familia's oldest priest and presiding clergyman, was a jovial 80-year-old with round glasses on a round face that was always smiling atop his tiny, robe-draped body. Benya's dream was to live long enough to see the completion of this glorious shrine. Tonight, however, inside his clerical office, Father Benya was not smiling. He had stayed late on church business, but had ended up riveted to his computer, entirely caught up in the disturbing drama unfolding in Bilbao. Edmund Kirsch was assassinated. Over the last 3 months, Benya had forged a delicate and unlikely friendship with Kirsch. The outspoken atheist had stunned Benya by approaching him personally with an offer to make a huge donation to the church. The amount was unprecedented and would have an enormous positive impact. Kirsch's offer makes no sense, Benya had thought, suspecting a catch. Is it a publicity stunt? Perhaps he wants influence over the construction? In return for his donation, the renowned futurist had made only one request. Benya had listened, uncertain. That's all he wants? This is a personal matter for me, Kirsch had said, and I'm hoping you'll be willing to honor my request. Benya was a trusting man, and yet in that moment he sensed he was dancing with the devil. Benya found himself searching Kirsch's eyes for some ulterior motive. And then he saw it. Behind Kirsch's carefree charm, there burned a weary desperation, his sunken eyes and thin body reminding Benya of his days in seminary, working as a hospice counselor. Edmund Kirsch, is ill. Benyo wondered if the man was dying, and if this donation might be a sudden attempt to make amends with the god whom he had always scorned. The most self-righteous in life become the most fearful in death. Benya thought about the earliest Christian evangelist, St. John, who had dedicated his life to encouraging non-believers to experience the glory of Jesus Christ. It seemed that if a non-believer like Kirsch wanted to participate in the creation of a shrine to Jesus, then denying him that connection would be both unchristian and cruel. In addition, there was the matter of Benya's professional obligation to help raise funds for the church, and he could not imagine informing his colleagues that Kirsch's giant gift had been rejected because of the man's history of outspoken atheism. In the end, Benya accepted Kirsch's terms, and the men had shaken hands warmly. That was 3 months ago. Tonight, Benya had watched Kirsch's presentation at the Guggenheim, first feeling troubled by its anti-religious tone, then intrigued by Kirsch's references to a mysterious discovery, and ultimately horrified to see Edmund Kirsch gunned down. In the aftermath, Benya had been unable to leave his computer, riveted by what was quickly becoming a dizzying kaleidoscope of competing conspiracy theories. Feeling overwhelmed, Benya now sat quietly in the cavernous sanctuary, alone in Gaudí's forest of pillars. The mystical woods, however, did little to calm his racing mind. What did Kirsch discover? Who wanted him dead? Father Benya closed his eyes and tried to clear his thoughts, but the questions kept recurring. Where do we come from? Where are we going?
We come from God, Benya declared aloud, and we go to God.
As he spoke, he felt the words resonate in his chest with such force that the entire sanctuary seemed to vibrate. Suddenly a bright shaft of light pierced the stained glass window above the Passion facade and streamed down into the basilica. Awestruck, Father Benya stood up and staggered toward the window, the entire church now thundering as the beam of celestial light descended along the colored glass. When he burst out of the church's main doors, Benya found himself assaulted by a deafening windstorm. Above him to the left, a massive helicopter was descending out of the sky, its searchlight strafing the front of the church. Benya watched in disbelief as the aircraft touched down inside the perimeter of the construction fences on the northwestern corner of the compound and powered down. As the wind and noise subsided, Father Benya stood in the main doorway of Sagrada Familia and watched as four figures descended from the craft and hurried toward him. The two in front were instantly recognizable from tonight's broadcast. One was the future Queen of Spain, and the other was Professor Robert Langdon. They were tailed by two strapping men in monogrammed blazers. From the look of things, Langdon had not kidnapped Ambra Vidal after all. As the American professor approached, Ms. Vidal appeared to be by his side entirely by her own choice.
"Father," the woman called with a friendly wave, "please forgive our noisy intrusion into this sacred space. We need to speak to you right away. It's very important."
Benya opened his mouth to reply, but could only nod mutely as the unlikely group arrived before him. "Our apologies, Father," said Robert Langdon with a disarming smile. "I know this must all seem very strange. Do you know who we are?"
"Of course," he managed, "but I thought..."
"Bad information," Ambra said. "Everything is fine, I assure you."
Just then, two security guards stationed outside the perimeter fence raced in through the security turnstiles, understandably alarmed by the helicopter's arrival. The guards spotted Benya and dashed toward him. Instantly, the two men in monogrammed blazers spun and faced them, extending their palms in the universal symbol for halt. The guards stopped dead in their tracks, startled, looking to Benya for guidance.
"Tot está bé," Benya shouted in Catalan. "Tornin al seu lloc."
"All is well. Return to your post." The guards squinted up at the unlikely assembly, looking uncertain.
"Son els meus convidats,"
Benya declared, firmly now. They are my guests.
Confio en la seva discrecio.
I will rely on your discretion. The bewildered guards retreated through the security turnstile to resume their patrol of the perimeter.
Thank you, Ambra said. I appreciate that.
I am Father Joachim Benya, he said. Please, tell me what this is about.
Robert Langdon stepped forward and shook Benya's hand. Father Benya, we are looking for a rare book owned by the scientist Edmund Kirsch. Langdon produced an elegant note card and handed it to him. This card claims the book is on loan to this church. Though somewhat dazed by the group's dramatic arrival, Benya recognized the ivory card at once. An exact copy of this card accompanied the book that Kirsch had given him a few weeks ago, The Complete Works of William Blake. The stipulation of Edmund's large donation to Sagrada Familia had been that Blake's book be placed on display in the Basilica crypt. A strange request, but a small price to pay. Kirsch's one additional request, outlined on the back of the linen card, was that the book always remain propped open to page 163. Chapter 66. 5 miles to the northwest of Sagrada Familia, Admiral Avila gazed through the windshield of the Uber at the broad expanse of city lights, which glittered against the blackness of the Balearic Sea beyond. Barcelona at last, the old naval officer thought, pulling out his phone and calling the regent as promised. The regent answered on the first ring.
Admiral Avila, where are you?
Minutes outside the city.
Your arrival is well timed. I have just received troubling news.
Tell me.
You have successfully severed the head of the snake. However, just as we feared, the long tail is still writhing dangerously.
How can I be of service? Avila asked.
When the regent shared his desires, Avila was surprised. He had not imagined that the night would entail any more loss of life, but he was not about to question the regent.
I am no more than a foot soldier, he reminded himself.
This mission will be dangerous, the regent said. If you are caught, show the authorities the symbol on your palm. You will be freed shortly. We have influence everywhere. I don't intend to be caught,
Avila said, glancing at his tattoo.
Good, the regent said in an eerily lifeless tone. If all goes according to plan, soon they will both be dead and all of this will be over.
The connection was broken. In the sudden silence, Avila raised his eyes to the brightest point on the horizon, a hideous cluster of deformed spires ablaze with construction lights. Sagrada Familia, he thought, repulsed by the whimsical silhouette, a shrine to all that is wrong with our faith. Barcelona's celebrated church, Avila believed, was a monument to weakness and moral collapse, a surrender to liberal Catholicism brazenly twisting and distorting thousands of years of faith into a warped hybrid of nature worship, pseudoscience, and Gnostic heresy. There are giant lizards crawling up a Church of Christ. The collapse of tradition in the world terrified Avila. But he felt buoyed by the appearance of a new group of world leaders who apparently shared his fears and were doing whatever it took to restore tradition. Avila's own devotion to the Palmarian Church, and especially to Pope Innocent XIV, had given him a new reason to live, helping him see his own tragedy through an entirely new lens. My wife and child were casualties of war, Avila thought. A war waged by the forces of evil against God, against tradition. Forgiveness is not the only road to salvation. 5 nights ago, Avila had been asleep in his modest apartment when he was awoken by the loud ping of an arriving text message on his cell phone.
It's midnight, he grumbled.
hazily squinting at the screen to find out who had contacted him at this hour. Numero oculto. Avila rubbed his eyes and read the incoming message. Compruebe su saldo bancario. Check my bank balance. Avila frowned, now suspecting some kind of telemarketing scam. Annoyed, he got out of bed and walked to the kitchen to get a drink of water. As he stood at the sink, he glanced over at his laptop, knowing he would probably not get back to sleep until he took a look. He logged on to his bank's website, fully anticipating seeing his usual, pitifully small balance, the remains of his military pension. However, when his account information appeared, he leaped to his feet so suddenly that he knocked over a chair. But that's impossible. He closed his eyes and then looked again. Then he refreshed the screen. The number remained. He fumbled with the mouse, scrolling to his account activity, and was stunned to see that an anonymous deposit of 100,000 euros had been wired into his account an hour earlier. The source was numbered and untraceable. Who would do this? The sharp buzzing of his cell phone made Avila's heart beat faster. He grabbed his phone and looked at his caller ID. Numero oculto. Avila stared at the phone and then seized it. See? A soft voice spoke to him in pure Castilian Spanish. Good evening, Admiral. I trust you have seen the gift we sent you?
I have, he stammered. Who are you?
You may call me the Regent, the voice replied. I represent your brethren, the members of the church that you have faithfully attended for the past 2 years. Your skills and loyalty have not gone unnoticed, Admiral. We would now like to give you the opportunity to serve a higher purpose. His Holiness has proposed for you a series of missions, tasks sent to you by God. Avila was now fully awake, his palms sweating. The money we gave you is an advance on your first mission, the voice continued. If you choose to carry out the mission, consider it an opportunity to prove yourself worthy of taking a place within our highest ranks. He paused. There exists a powerful hierarchy in our church that is invisible to the world. We believe you would be an asset at the top of our organization. Although excited by the prospect of advancement, Avila felt wary.
What is the mission? And what if I choose not to carry it out?
You will not be judged in any way, and you may keep the money in return for your secrecy. Does that sound reasonable?
It sounds quite generous.
We like you. We want to help you. And out of fairness to you, I want to warn you that the Pope's mission is a difficult one. He paused. It may involve violence. Avila's body went rigid. Violence. Admiral, the forces of evil are growing stronger every day. God is at war, and wars entail casualties. Avila flashed on the horror of the bomb that had killed his family. Shivering, he banished the dark memories.
I'm sorry. I don't know if I can accept a violent mission.
The Pope handpicked you, Admiral, the regent whispered. The man you will target in this mission is the man who murdered your family. Chapter 67. Located on the ground floor of Madrid's royal palace, the armory is an elegantly vaulted chamber whose high crimson walls are adorned with magnificent tapestries depicting famous battles in Spain's history. Encircling the room is a priceless collection of more than 100 suits of handcrafted armor, including the battle garb and tools of many past kings. 7 life-size horse mannequins stand in the center of the room, posed in full battle gear.
This is where they decide to keep me prisoner?
Garza wondered, looking out at the implements of war that surrounded him. Admittedly, the armory was one of the most secure rooms in the palace, but Garza suspected his captors had chosen this elegant holding cell in hopes of intimidating him. "This is the very room in which I was